Well, it's a joy to be with you once again, and this time, as you've just been told, I'm dealing with the subject of parenting, or better still, parent-child relations in the whole context of marriage or family life. And therefore, I will just ask you to turn with me to Ephesians and chapter 6, the famous passage that deals with marriage and family life. Ephesians and chapter 6. And while you've got your fingers there, it is worth my mentioning the fact that when one observes the commencement of human history, it is not long before you begin to realize one of the most important responsibilities of marriage. Yesterday, we spent our time looking at this whole area of husband-wife relationship from Genesis and chapter 2. Well, Genesis chapter 3 quickly introduces sin into the world. And consequently, when you reach chapter 4, where Adam and Eve, the first parents on earth, are given children, you immediately see the awesome responsibility that we have been given as human beings to bring other human beings into the world and to prepare them for the responsibilities of adulthood in later life and the judgment day in the life to come. You see it very easily, because the very first children born on planet Earth, at least as far as the male children are concerned, we have here Cain and Abel, two brothers, and before long, one murders the other. And it's very clear that even the surviving one has a very serious difficulty in his relationship to God and also his relationship to others who may catch up with him in due season. All that is clearly saying to us that there is a very big responsibility that those who are bringing children into the world have to play in preparing them for those relationships. Relationships with God's world and relationships with the God the Father. Indeed, before again we get to Ephesians 6, you just have to go to the next chapter, and that is dealing with chapter 5 of Genesis, when again you notice the whole place of child bearing and child rearing, because again and again the theme of the music, or better still the rhythm of the music, is so and so lived so many years, he became the father of so and so. After that, he lived so many more years with so many other children that he gave birth to, and he died. And the one that he had given birth to lived for so many years, and in due season also gave birth to so and so, and then lived so many years and had other sons and daughters. What's the basic message there? It is the fact that this whole responsibility of bringing up the next generation is perhaps the most important responsibility that you have as individuals coming together in marriage, that you have as families. Now, When you consider the real power of the fallen nature with which the child is born, I'm sure you know when the psalmist David cries out that surely in sin my mother conceived me, he is not talking in terms of the fact that there was a sinful sexual relationship between his father and his mother, but rather he is referring to the fact that he was born a sinner. In fact, he was conceived a sinner. When you think about the real power of that sinful nature that children are born with, you also think in terms of the negative influence of the world into which the child is coming and the child will be growing. When you add onto that difficult, threatening list the sworn enmity of Satan, the chief enemy of God, his commitment to destroy the soul of your child, you begin to ask the question, who can equal such a task? Who can equal such a task? And it is for this reason, therefore, that I quickly draw your attention to Ephesians chapter 6, because in those first four verses we have something of God's answer to that question. How are we to go about realizing that responsibility that God has given us? Let me just quickly read these verses to you. Ephesians 6 and verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you, and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. See, God may not, in his sovereignty, be pleased to give you children, at least in terms of being born from you. But when he does so, he is not giving you toys to play with. We need to appreciate that. Parenting is an awesome responsibility. He is making you a guardian. He is giving you the role of being his representative in the life of that child, so that you may move that child from the position of absolute dependence on everything to the position where that child can now move on to live his or her own life, taking on the responsibilities of adulthood as you yourself may have taken on those responsibilities. And the point is that you are going to be held accountable to God for that entire process. Now look at the passage that we've just read from. It may strike you that the Apostle Paul is beginning with children and then going on to speak to parents. I would like to suggest to you that the reason why the Apostle Paul does that is because the context in which he is writing is a context of submission. And so when you read chapter 5 and verse 21, the Apostle Paul there says, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And so his major theme is that of submission. And consequently, between husband and wife, he begins with wife and then turns to the husband, who must love the wife as Christ loved the church. Similarly, when it comes to parent-child relationship, he begins with the child who must obey the parents and tends to the parents and speaks about their role of bringing up the children in a way that is pleasing to God. And similarly, when he deals with employer and employee, he begins with the employee who must obey the employer or the master, and then he turns to the master and says, be fair and just in your dealing with those over whom you are masters. So it is the context that really makes the Apostle Paul begin with the submitter and then proceed to deal with the one under whom he submits. In actual practice, the tone of the relationship is not set by the one who submits or obeys. The tone is set by the one who is head over that relationship. So between husband and wife, the tone is set by the husband. Between parents and children, the tone is set by parents. And again, in the working environment, the tone is set by those who are in management, those who own the means of production. And that's where I want us to begin from. And that's the reason why, in the brief time I have with you this afternoon, we will spend our time in that fourth verse. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. In the matter of parent-child relationship, the first thing we need to ensure is in place is what I'm calling here in my notes, the father figure. The father figure. Now, of course, with a single parent situation, there's a sense in which the mother has a dual role to play, and consequently, it will not be easy. However, we are trusting here that we are dealing with a situation where both parents are alive, and so that's where we want to begin from. When the Apostle Paul refers to fathers here, his major concern is the authoritative figure in the child's mind. The authoritative figure in the child's mind. Where this figure is missing, you have a recipe for disaster. One of the very first lessons a child has to learn, perhaps while still crawling on all fours, is that my will is not the most important will on planet Earth. That there is another will, which when it says no, it is no. Even if I kick up tantrums, it is still no. And if I insist on going ahead, pain is the inevitable consequence. That figure is all important in the life of the child. Why is that so? It is because the goal of parenting, and you need to please take note of this, the goal of parenting is to enable a human being, when outside the context of a human authority, to still be subjected to another authority. Of course, We can be thinking in terms of state authority. We'll come to that a little later on. But ultimately, it is God's authority. So the aim is that by the time this child has left my home and is an independent individual, raising his own home in his own business or industry, he will not think that what he wants must happen, but that there is another will to whom he should subject his will. And that will is God. When a child leaves home, therefore, he should be able to say, "Our Father who is in heaven." And that should register the sense of authority that he had when once upon a time he said, "Our Father who is at home." That parallel needs to be there. It must be sealed upon the child's conscience. So, if we're going to speak in terms of parent-child relationship, those of you who are parents, take it as one of your most immediate goals that that child needs to know what it means to be under God's authority, and that you are representing that. Sometimes back home in Zambia, I do quite a bit of visitation, sometimes among my own church members, and sometimes it's other people and so forth. And you can be there in what we call the sitting room. Other places would call it a lounge. And I'm trying to speak to parents. And then there's this little kid who is clearly his own boss, doing as he pleases. And of course, the parents are there. Let's suppose the little child's name is Tommy. And come on, Tommy, sit down. And, you know, they sort of turn around. And what happens? It's the cushion on the, next to the boy that goes flying and hits the parent's head. You shouldn't be throwing cushions around. And while they're trying to talk, the next thing, the hi-fi system is blowing loud. And again, Tommy, can't you see we've got a pastor here? We need a bit of... Okay, why don't you go and play with the TV in the next room? And Tommy sort of goes off for a few minutes. And you've hardly begun speaking when, you know, he's back and he's pulling something back into the sitting room and begins to climb onto the windowsill and jumping Batman style onto one of the cities. And then you hear the father say, "Pastor, I think let's go and sit outside." That's totally wrong. You are producing a disaster in society by that approach. Your responsibility, your very first responsibility, is for that child to realize there's such a thing as a father figure, an authoritative figure outside his own will. And when that figure says stop it, when that figure says no, when that figure says now keep quiet, when that figure says go out of here, the child realizes that that's the will that must take over, his will. And if he insists on taking his own course, pain is a consequence of it. And since he does not want misery as a consequence of disobedience, he moves on to obey that figure. And as I said, as early in life as possible, get that into place. While still in the napkins, sucking his or her thumb, ensure that the last voice is yours. Not because it's the loudest, but because it's been singing for the last 1 hour. Because it is the authoritative voice. Okay, so that's the first thing. In your relationship with the child, ensure that the father figure is in place. Number two, parenting in many ways is like walking a tight rope. In other words, it's very easy to end up on one extreme or the other. And it's possible, therefore, in one extreme or the other to lead to what the Apostle Paul calls here the exasperation of a child. The reason is quite simple. You know that we can all walk on a tightrope? We all can. As long as it's for a split of a second. The difficulty is the distance we have to cover. And in that sense, we are all exceptionally good at parenting for 1 hour. But when it's going to be parenting for about 20 years of a child's life, it's that long distance haul that is the real challenge. And that's where this walking of the tightrope becomes so difficult. We easily, along the way, lose our balance. And usually, the one who suffers is the child. Because the child is on the receiving end. I've got, and this is probably in my notes, the little booklet that you've been able to get. I've got about 6 or 7 areas that often cause children at different levels of life to really be frustrated, to begin to develop a bitterness. And unfortunately, when children do develop that bitterness, you have failed. Because when they finally leave your home, they leave with a vengeance. And often the vengeance is not upon you, it's upon everybody else who is close to them or under them. And that's not the kind of product God wants you to deliver into his world. Let me quickly give you a rest through them. I will not expand on them largely because time is not with us. If we come to the question and answer situation or sessions, then perhaps we can spend a little more time on those that you want us to speak about. The first thing that frustrates or embitters children is when their stages of growth are not recognized. Now, I'll come a little later to speak a little more about this whole area of stages of growth. And one of you might ask me where in the Bible to find it. We'll try and find it there. But the point is, I, for instance, can shout at my little kid when he's playing with his friends, and at that stage his sense of ego has not really developed to a point where what is crushing him is how can mom and dad shout at me like that in the presence of my friends. When they're still very young, they don't think like that. It's simply, what have I done? I'm going to be in trouble. Therefore, they quickly realign their lives. But a time comes, and I'm just giving this as a typical example, when a child enters into that stage where my name among my friends is my greatest possession. The last thing they want is to be shouted at and consequently embarrassed before their friends. Now, it's important for a parent to recognize the fact that my child is in this phase. And consequently, If I'm going to embarrass him before his friends, it is because I intentionally intend. That's a repetition. I intentionally mean to do so. It's not simply because I've lost my temper and then I'm shouting right through the house and so on. I don't know why I gave birth to you and things like that. That's you're really going the wrong way. So it will be a deliberate ploy that I think he's behaving like this because he's seeing his friends here. Very well then. Let me make it clear to him that having your friends here is no passport to behaving as you please. And consequently, when we talk about it afterwards in the bedroom, I'll be able to say to him, I did this deliberately and I know you have lost face before your friends. I know tomorrow you'll be trying to re-explain your situation and so on, but you just need to learn this. Okay, so there's a sense in which I am recognizing the stages of my child's growth, and we'll come to that a little more. To fail to do that is to embitter your child unnecessarily. The second way in which children, and I think these things are important because they deal with parent-child relationships, and I'm sure when we come to discussion, those of you who are in the context of children may feel that this is where my parents might be failing me. And it is when children do not have a sense of home in the home. Children must grow up with a sense that they've got a retreat center away from the demands of this world, away from trying to maintain themselves in the stress of life and living out there. A place where they are understood. A place where they can let down their hair. A place where they can say, this is my little world. Now, when parents rob children of that, they grow up not having a sense of home, not having a retreat parlor. And consequently, even when they are raising their own children and having their own homes, they do not treasure the fact that one of my primary responsibilities is to create a place where those who are under my roof can say, home, sweet home. And please don't overlook the word sweet. Every human being needs a place where they can relax. It is Jesse Ryle who says that even a bow, you know, bow and arrow, even a bow needs time when you must unstring it. Otherwise, it loses its elasticity. That's the way we are as human beings as well. If a person doesn't have a place where he can release himself and then go back into the stressful world and again come out and release himself, if he's constantly out there under stress, in here under worse stress, and out there again under stress, you're obviously developing somebody who's going to be a misfit in society. Quickly, the third area. And it is when corrective discipline is used and no formative discipline is in place. What I mean by this is, as parents, we need to be conscious of the fact that children also want to be commended. Children also need to be told the right way, and not only to be told when they've gone the wrong way. And consequently, we have this whole area of training. Bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. In other words, we need to be conscious about the fact that we are bringing up children, and we are to do it first of all in a positive way. If you bring up boys, well, train them about what it means to be a man in God's world. And slowly, according to the various stages of their lives, help them to become responsible, to develop a sense of leadership and headship, to develop a sense of their own authority being subjected to another's authority, because they will have to give an account to him. Ladies will also have their own spheres in which they do need to be developed. So instead of always simply disciplining correctively, either in terms of words or in terms of physical punishment, smacking, or giving them some extra chores to do by way of discipline, first of all, help them to see what they should have done, so that if they don't do it, then they know their guilt. Or they should know what they shouldn't do, that when they do it, they will know that in fact I do deserve what has come my way. The fourth area is when you as a parent, your example contradicts your words. To be insisting to your children that they should be hard working, when all they see of you is a person who is at home yawning away the hours, it confuses them. Because the message that's coming to them is that growing up means relaxing. We are simply slaves to these big people. And the sooner we grow out of slavery, the better. But if by your example, you are hard working, and then you are commending hard working, it makes sense. I've never forgotten one time my father telling me that I should never be a smoker of cigarettes. Now, while he was telling me not to be a smoker of cigarettes, I was going, okay, son, this is very bad for you. Very bad. I thought, now, it's very bad for my lungs. He seemed to be enjoying it there as they're talking to me. I had real difficulties coming to terms with that. Well, thankfully, in this season, he kicked the habit. But it's that kind of situation I'm talking about. You need to see that your life speaks much louder than your words. And therefore, you can easily frustrate your children by trying to instruct them to do things that in your own life you clearly don't do. The fifth area, very quickly, is that you frustrate your children if you are not providing for their needs. Children are meant to be provided for. A time will come when they'll have to provide for themselves. Granted, it's not one finishes here and the other one begins there. There is a going from white into gray and then into black. There is a progression out of the providing stage. But the point I'm trying to stress is that at that point where a child recognizes that this is something I ought to be receiving from my parents and I am not receiving it, you easily embitter them. Now, there are basic things like food, clothing, education, and so on. These are basics which you don't need to tell a child that they are to get this from you. It is something you indeed must see yourself as a parent as obligated towards God to provide for your children. Well, if you are failing because of real circumstances around you, that will be something at least a child can understand as you communicate. And a child should understand. But where it is negligence, that's a different matter. And or wrong priorities, that's equally a different matter. And you may have to seek to sit down and redress the situation. The sixth area that I have here is when you cut across their sense of justice and fair play. Their sense of justice and fair play. Now, I'm sure those of you who are younger here will have a lot of stories in terms of times in the past when this has happened, and perhaps even those of us who are older will remember situations like that. I recall one of them. My mother died when I was only 9 years old, so I was brought up by my mother's immediate elder sister in her family from about the age of 9 until I went to university around the age of 16, 17. And I've never forgotten, on one occasion I had been sent by my auntie to go and call one of her daughters to come for lunch from a friend's home. And when I got there, they told me what she had been saying about me, and it was really embarrassing stuff. My adrenaline shot up, but I tried to control myself. We got back home, and I told my auntie, this is what she has been doing. Now, I know my auntie was wise. She later on explained to me that in her thinking, she thought, okay, I'll handle it after lunch. The problem is she didn't say it. So she just kept quiet and then said, go and wash your hands. And, you know, back home we eat our main meal with our hands. So off went to wash our hands, and I beat up my cousin. I took the law into my own hands. If she would do it, I will do it myself. I had withheld my anger for quite some distance. Now I poured it out on her. Well, in the process, you know, we lost out on lunch because, I mean, she couldn't eat. She was crying. My auntie sorted me out. I was also crying. But until she took me aside and then explained to me that, look, I knew I needed to deal with this matter. It's just that if I handled it now, one of the two of you was not going to eat. That made sense to me. If only she had said it a little earlier. So this cutting across one's sense of justice and fair play, apparently favoring one child against the other, can cause a lot of bitterness. Here's my last, and it is this, that when you are too busy with other things to be with children and listen to them. When you are too busy with other things to be with children and listen to them. Now, we'll be talking in terms of the different stages of growth and consequently the kind of demands that children make upon us as parents, as adults. And you need to be conscious of the fact that this is the kind of demand that this child has upon us, and we need to provide the time. We need to be available to them so that they feel as though we really care about their world and about what they are going through. Now, that I must obviously leave to you to judge whether you are not exasperating those who are under you or not. One good way of doing it is to ask the child. It can be quite revealing. Back home, we do it on their birthdays. On everyone's birthday, we say, this is the one day when you are given absolute freedom to speak out your mind without vengeance coming from anywhere. So you speak to each one in the home about how your relationship has been over the last 1 year. That person will also speak to you. And it's a very good occasion because the child knows, well, my friend had this opportunity to say, and now this is also my opportunity to also bring out, and so on. And the child can bring out something, at least if there's sufficient freedom, about the fact that, you know, Dad, I think you favor the girls in the family. I think you really do. Because, you know, us boys, when you do this, these are the consequences. But when they do this, you know, this is... And it's their perspective they are coming across to you. You may have other ways in which to elicit that freedom of speech from those who are under you and provide that kind of opportunity. As I said, it may be revealing and sometimes it may be quite humbling. I've not forgotten one of my sons much earlier on that opportunity saying to me, and it wasn't so much in the home context, it was to do with church. He said, Dad, when you preach, remember us children, all right? We are also there in your congregation. That was quite revealing. I had to sort of take a bit of time to look again at my sermons and wonder what it is about them that's making them be geared a lot more to the giraffes in the congregation than to the little lambs who are there. Okay, the point is, avoid exasperation. Avoid embittering your children. Now, that's not saying your children must never cry, must never feel pain. But the point is, it must be deliberate, rather than the fact that you are just releasing your anger, and in the process, the grass under your feet ends up suffering. It should never be that way. And again, husband and wife, it's important. If one of you is causing needless tears and needless pain, to make it part of bedroom talk. Make it clear, this is not helpful. This is leading the children into a realm of bitterness. Please control yourself. These children are only with us for this season. They will be gone. Let us give them the inestimable privilege of having been brought up into this, in this kind of context. Okay, now that's a negative statement. Don't do this and don't do the other. The positive is the one that the Apostle Paul ends with, when he says, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. I think it's important for us to recognize the fact that our children go through stages. By the time they leave home, usually it's somewhere between their 20th birthday and the 25th. Maybe in your culture it's a little younger, but for us, generally speaking, the late teens, they are a little bit more in and out, but somewhere between the age of 20 and 25, mother has to shed tears because the final parting seems to be taking place. The young man who was a little toddler in her arms is now a man wanting so much space that she better get out of his way. The young lady as well feels, now the time has come for me to face the world, and mother still thinks she's still not old enough to face it, but she feels it's now my time to get out there. In the process, there are a lot of stages. Now, I'll just give them to you roughly so that you can appreciate. Generally speaking, the first stage of a child's life is one in which they are just picking up whatever they are hearing. Even language, they don't pick it up because they've learned syllables and adjectives and nouns and verbs and so on. No. It's being spoken, they pick it up and they begin to speak it. And you find in that context, if you call your husband honey or sweetie, one day your child will suddenly call your husband honey or sweetie, and you have to say, now, that's my prerogative, all right? You know, for you it is this. Simply because that's the way they pick it up. They see you answering the phone. They'll go and pick up the handset and also start talking, not knowing that in actual fact, when you do put it against your ear, there is an actual voice speaking. They just assume you're just saying words and they do the same. So that's an initial stage in any child's life, and it obviously a parent has to relate to a child at that level. And then there is a second stage in which a child begins to process the information that it's been picking in terms of questions. All right, and I think for us as parents, that may be the first stage that sends us into chaos or bananas, because the child is asking about everything. Go and get me water. Why? Why is it that you send me to get water, I don't send you to get me water? And these are genuine questions. The child is beginning to ask the why questions. This information needs to start getting into some structure in the mind. The child will be, in fact, I remember asking a similar question to my father once. He arrived home, was tired, he took off his shoes, and then says, go get me my slippers. Okay, I took his shoes, I went to get the slippers, came back, gave them to him. And then I said, Dad, why is it that you're always sending me to get things? And I've never forgotten his answer. He said, no, you also send me. I said, no, I don't. So he says, when your school shoes finish, don't you send me to go and buy you new school shoes? Yeah, you're right. So things fell into play. So in that stage, again, you need to be conscious. What's happening is that your child is now trying to develop some structure with respect to all this information that has begun to fill up the hard drive, so to speak. The next stage of a child's life, basically, is one where the child is now beginning to find himself. So he's picked up a lot of information along the way. He's sort of put it into different little boxes. It's beginning to take some structure. Then his own personality is giving expression to that. Now, we normally refer to that as adolescence, and a lot of parents find it extremely difficult to handle adolescence in children. But again, it's the God-given process of getting ready to be his own out there. And in the adolescent stage, in fact, even your religion is put to serious question. Because a child is now not simply wanting to ask questions, but is wanting to pick out of all that information that which he likes, that which is himself. Or, sorry ladies, or girls, that I keep saying he, I'm including the she's, all right? So please throw yourselves into that bandwagon as well. She's also thinking about herself? How would she like to do this and to do that? Now, at that stage, what you're going through is not so much the question as the value. The child has a value system, which is like a sieve. Some things are getting stuck and therefore being washed out of that child's life. Others are sinking through and then becoming part of that child's life. So you will find, for instance, that this child who grew up in church now rejects your faith. Now, that's an extremely painful experience to go through. And at first you will put up a gallant fight, and you may soon discover that it's actually your faith the child had all along. Now he is really saying, I don't think God is there, or if he is there, I don't think he is the God that the Bible represents, and so on. He has come out that way. Or you may have been a reformed parent and your child goes charismatic, or vice versa. All right. You may argue until your face turns blue about the matter. The child has adopted this in his value system, in that those holes, and that's something that you have to live with. It's the same thing with the child's music, their taste of music, their taste of clothing. Previously, you went to the shops and you bought the child's clothes and the child would say thank you. But now it's, Mom, do you honestly expect me to wear this? Sorry, I'm not. Okay, thank you very much for your preference. But no. Can I go back and exchange it for something else? And you say, all right. And so when the child comes back with what is their option, you are saying, daughter, you think you will wear that in my home? Sorry. I won't have you going out of that door dressed like that. Forget it. When you finally left my home and you've got your own home, you can dress as you please. It's the value system. And of course, I'll just touch a little bit on the important issues there in terms of the training and bring up of the child. The last stage, ultimately, is young adulthood. And in that stage, it's now the outworking of those values. The choice of career, the choice of friends, the choice of the kind of person to marry or get married to. In fact, some of them at that time will actually find the spouse and proceed to get married, and so on and so forth. That's the last stage, and basically, at that point, you've got very little to do with the choices that they end up making. Okay, now, quickly, Your role in training obviously differs in each stage. In the first stage of life, when your child is picking up anything and everything, your child is like a sponge, and your greatest responsibility is filling up that sponge with the right material. It will suck up anything. So your role is to make sure that you've got the right anything that's going into the system. If your child is surrounded by wrong people, wrong language, wrong sites, you can be sure it's going to be garbage in and garbage out. So it's very important that at that stage you are putting in a lot of good things, godly things, biblical information. Even if it's not being processed, don't worry. This stage is about input and input and input. Make sure all the stories about Noah and the ark, about David and Goliath, about all those, Samson and Delilah and so on, all those are getting into the realm. Okay. The second stage, I'm sure we'll, if you've got questions, we'll deal with that. Just want to quickly finish. In the second stage, your important role is to help to develop the reasoning capacity of your child. Don't give easy, or better still, silly answers. Also, don't shrug off those questions. Go and ask your teacher. I'm busy, can't you see? How do you ask a silly question? The child is trying to put things into some logical order. Help to develop your child's reasoning process so that your child will end up having the kind of reasoning that will defy the world's unreasonableness. And you'll agree with me, the world is terribly unreasonable. An obvious example is the whole teaching concerning evolution. All you need is to have a proper reasoning process. Evolution goes out through the window. That's why we always say you need more faith to be an evolutionist than a creationist, because it is unreasonable when you follow its logic to its conclusion, you go down the cliff. Okay, so be there to answer those questions, and not only to answer those questions, help your child develop their reasoning capacity. Very quickly, the next stage is the stage where the child is going through adolescence and consequently finding themselves. There, it is in terms of helping your child develop proper value system. Now, what I need to say very quickly at this point is that in actual fact, the information you were initially giving, the reasoning process you have come to, those are building blocks towards this stage. That's the reason why a child who comes to you having just entered into their teenage years, to start giving them new values is a third world war. Because the initial material had nothing to do with your values. The logic has not been developed, at least properly. And so this child now wants to find himself, and then you are cutting in on what he wants to do, what she wants to do, and all they think is he hates me, she hates me, and they enter into a fighting mode, and you hardly get anywhere. Okay, so it's important to go through that stage. By the time you are coming to the last stage, by the way, your most important role is to be there. is to be there for that child who's about to leave home. It's at the level where that relationship with them is about to part ways. And consequently, you might want to make it feel as though it is as tough as it initially was. Your child doesn't think so. The other relationships that are coming into your child's life are taking on the center stage. It's God's way of preparing your child to leave and cleave and so on and so forth where your child is going. But to be there as a kind of elder brother, as a kind of elder sister, so that there is still the sense of this man and this woman, they've got wisdom. So this difficulty that I have, I can run to them. I can trust what they will say to me. And because they love me, they will give me what is best for me. It is essentially that relationship that becomes the most fundamental relationship at that stage. It is sad if a child is going through that process, especially thinking in terms of someone to marry or get married to, keep it as a secret from you. Just know there's something you've done wrong. But if they are willing to say, you know, Dad, assuming it's a young man, you know, I've often wanted to marry a lady who's like mom. And, you know, there's this girl in my class. Ah, you're getting somewhere. Oh, a young lady saying to the mother while doing chores in the kitchen, you know, John has been getting uncomfortably close, you know. I think he's up to something. That kind of conversation is healthy because then you know that we have the rapport that is healthy. And not to simply discover one day somebody arrives and is saying, I want your daughter's hand. And you can't differentiate him from a block of wood. You've never seen him. That's obviously a rather difficult situation. Okay, I think essentially I'd like to pause there. I do have one or two things to say, but I think I've taken about an hour. Maybe let me just say one more thing and I will close. And it is simply this, that please remember that your relationship with your child is a long haul. So in the crisis of the moment, don't think you've lost everything. Bring the relationship into the appropriate direction so that you can continue playing your formative role in your child's life. Turning it the other way around, speaking to those of you who might be in the child-parent relationship, bear in mind that your parents are your God-given guardians in the long haul. You may detest the way in which they have handled you at this point and may wet your pillow with tears. Bear in mind that it is for a certain season and they are simply seeking to prepare you for that day when you finally go out of that door with a final bye. Both parents and children, therefore I say, take maximum benefit of that season. It will soon be over.